And it's like, if you think about it, in a way, you know, magic's almost like a form of performance art, you know?
Let me ask you a question and please answer honestly.
Okay.
Is this your way of telling... Are you a magician?
I know it may seem that way, but rest assured, I am merely a fan.
Okay, phew.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Testing.
Perfect.
Microphone.
It's the first Australian voice we've had.
It's highly marketable.
Do you find that it's an advantage to be, excuse me, I'm just setting up my recorder here, to be international in this town?
Significantly.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the running joke, which is completely true, is that until I came to LA or the US, I had never in my life uttered the phrase g'day. Now I lead every conversation with it.
Really?
Yeah.
Purposely?
Yeah, deliberately. Like, g'day. That's now my opening. Because I don't have the strongest Australian accent. It's not like you're really Australian, yeah.
No, yeah, it's and a very, so, like, yeah, if very somebody mild. Who doesn't know, you'd think it would be British almost.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, it's because I grew up in Australia, my dad's Australian, but my mum is actually British.
Okay.
So that's why I do have a genuine kind of hybrid, very mild accent.
That makes sense.
And particularly in like a noisy room, people sometimes don't even hear it at all, you know, initially for the first few minutes. That's why I now open with... G'day. So it's like immediately leading with my most marketable quality.
There you go. So, and it's memorable. You know?
Exactly. It stands out. You know, even if you're, it's that whole thing about, you know, if two magicians or performers are kind of comparable, but one has an interesting attribute, that person gets booked. You know, it's just, you know, if you're doing a show, you know, you want the woman or the foreigner or the, you know, the quirky, unusual act, you know, the minority or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And being international does make me a kind of advantaged minority in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I lean into that.
Sure. Yeah.
A lot.
So what brought you to the States? How long have you been here?
How long have you been here is always an interesting one. It's like when you have a relationship that was kind of on again, off again, but now you're together. It's like, when did you guys get together? Well, it depends on. I first visited here in 2007, which is, you know, like on the creative pilgrimage to see Vegas and the Magic Castle and, you know, New York and all that. Just see the magic scene, basically. And then I got my visa, my work visa approved about 2 years ago. It's about to run out and needs renewing.
Ooh.
I'm in the middle of that right now.
That's
a fun saga.
I've heard horror stories about that.
It's fingers crossed it's looking okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of at the stage where unless something screws up, you know, now I'm just making sure nothing unexpected screws up. And so I packed up my home in Australia October 2014. So, you know, nearly a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
Then I didn't end up with an apartment in LA until June 2015. So between October 2014 and June 2015 was a very interesting, strange period in my life where I was like staying on friends' couches here.
Mm-hmm.
Then I had 2 months of gigs back in Australia I had to go and do.
Oh, wow.
But then I left my stuff here, but then I came back here and it was just this kind of mess as I kind of bounced around finding an apartment. So really... Left, kind of October 2014 or really honestly June last year was when I really landed here fully with my own place. And I'm still furnishing it. Like, since then I've been traveling again and other stuff going on. I still haven't even really fully moved in, you know. So I'm still kind of in the process of landing
You're
here.
You're basically George Clooney and up in the air. He just
Pretty
never
much,
furnishes
yeah.
his apartment.
Yeah.
And then he's sad when he has
the difference
it.
Is I'm seeking to. I'm seeking to make a base here. Like, I would like to settle down. I mean, at least be more settled down than I have been. At least have a solid base where
sure.
I come from, you know.
Sure. And has your experience – what did you do in Australia? Were you doing corporate events, theaters over there?
Well, originally – so until 5 years ago, I actually worked for a full-time business consulting company.
Okay.
I was a Fortune 500 suit-wearing corporate guy. That was, you know, that was what I did out of university for about 5 years in that job while the magic thing was building up part-time in the background. And so 5 years ago – actually, no, 6 years ago now, I quit after, you know, a big build-up to – considering doing that, you know, leaving your very secure, very stable, well-paying job to go and be a magician. So I quit that. And then in Australia, I was kind of just still figuring out my business plan as a magician, like doing all kinds of bits and pieces, you know, mostly corporate events and private events, right? That's the bread and butter.
Sure.
But again, with punctuated runs of things like, you know, theater shows and festival shows, there still isn't really any one main thing I do. That's one of the reasons I'm here is to kind of settle down, build up a client base, work out what my actual you know, primary thread is, because right now I still do all kinds of different stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all kind of work to different degrees, but I haven't yet found, like, no one thing has really taken off in a huge way yet. So,
well, your Fringe show last year seemed to be pretty successful. Glitches in Reality, is that what it's called? Which I think is a brilliant title. I think it's one of my favorite titles. And Johnny
Hollywood.
He directed that. So it just, I mean, I was in Orlando still at the time, but just over the Facebook vine, it seemed like it was, you know, doing really well.
It was. And the issue with that is now at the stage where the show itself is kind of temporarily in hibernation while I kind of fix some issues with it. And what we're doing this year is kind of a, we're giving the show a new name and kind of using all the best bits of it kind of in a new form with some new material mixed in. You know, kind of like the, it makes me think of the way like Penn and Teller's show evolves. It's sort of the same show.
Stuff in and out.
But it keeps changing over time. Mm-hmm. And the question is now how to actually monetize it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it doesn't matter how good the show is. You've got to actually have a, you know, it's got to be either touring or resident regularly in a place or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's something that for me personally won't happen without a producer or a promoter or a, you know, an agent or a manager or something.
Yeah.
And that's honestly the biggest thing I'm now sort of seeking professionally is finding those alliances. You know, working with John, for example, has been great, but he's full-time on his own thing.
Yeah.
You know, we collaborate in ways, but he's not going to be the full-time producer and, you know. So I'm basically looking for, the phrase is looking for someone to exploit me for profit, you know, and we can mutually benefit from that. You know?
I'm in the same boat, especially where, because I did the Orlando Fringe, so I'm doing the same thing where I'm taking bits and pieces of what worked really well and then trying to re-put it together, and then same thing, find the producer, find the people that are going to push you, and, you know, that's the exhausting part.
And that's, God, I know, right? And it's the bit that we don't want to do. It's the bit that that's not our skill set. We're here to create entertainment and art, you know, rather than sell it and promote it.
Anybody who tells me that they want to be a magician, I'm like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Stay a hobbyist, because it gets hard when you have to start producing. Yeah. And
or at least make sure you understand that you're signing up for a different full-time job than the one you think you are.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. It's the same as if you're, you know, a drummer part-time and then I'm going to do this full-time, be a studio guy.
And then holy shit.
Yeah. And then your well-being depends on it. Mm.
But it still beats the cubicle.
Yeah.
It's like no regrets.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure, like, was that just a great thrusting point coming from corporate America, corporate Australia. And then was that just enough of I can't take this anymore?
Kind of, yeah. It was, I mean, the process that led to quitting, it took me about 2 years. Once I realized I had to quit and do it, it took me about 2 years to actually do it, you know, because of the fear and the anxiety. And, you know, it's a big, scary step. But the sort of the equation that it eventually came down to was, you know, one, I knew I had to do it eventually. Otherwise, I'd spend my whole life wondering what if, right? Unambiguously. There was no way I could not do this. Number two, I realized I'm the kind of person who never feels ready for anything. You know, like recovering perfectionist.
Yeah.
So I realized, you know, I wanted to wait till I'm ready, wait till the right moment. And I realized, number two, there's never going to be a right moment. There will never be a moment where I feel like I'm ready. And so three, if there's never going to be a right moment, might as well do it sooner than later. And I basically wrote my resignation letter like that week.
Wow.
And, you know, filed that. But it took me 2 years to kind of reach that simple realization of like ABC, like that simple algorithm.
Yeah. We were the same way when we moved to LA. It was just like, got to do it, got to get it out of the system. But that same feeling of, we'll get to it.
Eventually. And you realize, no, just suck it up and do it. It's just the hardest thing, but the best thing. You know,
I think one of the greatest things is just kind of looking over the past couple of years and realizing, oh, things aren't changing that much and they'll probably stay the same. And if you're okay with that, great. But if you want something more, you have to take a leap off the cliff and financially, that's going to suck for a while, especially if you're used to a steady paycheck.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of why, you know, we're in the middle of like looking at venues right now, but I'm probably doing Hollywood Fringe again this year because the other thing that Fringe festivals usually aren't super profitable. You know, they can be profitable, but compared to how much time and effort you put in, particularly self-producing or in this case, you know, co-producing with John again, it's going to be an insane amount of work.
Yeah.
For, you know, we'll make a, you know, couple of thousand bucks maybe for, you know, the whole thing, which, look, is great. I'm not complaining at all, but that's not
if you, like,
money.
Break that down hourly,
yeah,
you're getting paid
just
a couple
nothing.
Bucks an hour.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you do it because you get a chance to work on the show and you get to put it in front of people and showcase it and, you know, all the intangible benefits.
Yeah.
But for me, the biggest thing is it's like hopefully a stepping stone to getting better material showcased in front of more people. Again, to look for those alliances.
Sure.
And I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun, but also not looking forward to going, oh, man, it's going to be a grind.
I'm in that same boat right now. John and I were talking about it, and he's like, you know what? The goal is to make at least $8 a ticket when you're selling it for like 20.
Exactly.
Sorry, hang on one sec. My monitor shut off for a sec.
And the other thing John always jokes about is that the goal is to make Magic Castle money.
Sure.
Which, as we know, is not very good money.
It's not, but it's prestigious,
exactly,
you know.
Yeah.
I just got my first week at the castle in April.
Oh, nice.
And, yeah, it's something I worked for, like, 3 years to get. And then I look at the paycheck, and I'm like, this is fine.
What I love is the Magic Castle is one of the purest examples of, like, microeconomics. Supply
sure.
and demand.
Yeah.
They don't pay well because they don't have to.
Yeah.
Like, people still want to do it anyway. It's because it is one of the best gigs in show business.
Yeah.
It's an amazing week. It's an amazing place. You know, I do it. Don't tell them, but, you know, I'd do it if it paid less. You know, people would do it if it didn't pay at all. That's
have
not
you ever
why
done
do
Scott Neary's Booby Trap here?
I have, yeah.
I've done it a couple times, too.
Yeah.
And he just sent out an email where somebody.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Did you read that?
Yeah.
Somebody
email,
was complaining that he doesn't pay. And I've always been of that. You know, don't work for free mentality. But a show like his is such a great showcase.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten work because they did a 4-minute set there.
Exactly.
And, you know, I didn't make any money, but now I'm making money. So it's, I think you have to be careful about where you do it. And, you know, that's a great advantage because it's such a well-known show. Yeah. And, you know, it goes back to the prestige of doing it.
And also just the fun. Like doing Scott's, it's fun. It's hanging out with your friends and drinking and eating and then getting on stage and doing stuff.
Exactly.
You know, I always see those, you know, those things about the don't work for free, and I completely agree with the sentiment. You know, it's work for exposure, that's, you know, it's crap.
Yeah.
But
you can hand out a lot of business cards.
Exactly. Yay. But the excuse me. It amuses me. Sort of darkly amuses me when people get offended by being asked to work for free.
Sure.
Hell no. They have every right to ask you to work for free, and you have every right to say, no, I don't do that. That's fine. No one should be offended. It's cool. And then sometimes you go, actually, you know, like Scott's, I will do that for free.
Yeah.
That's a good gig. I like that one. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not forced to do it. I'm not pressured.
This town has been kind of an inspiration is the wrong word, but very enlightening in that I've seen so many big names do so many free shows here. You know, I've seen Willman do stuff. I saw Maria Banford do a small little set last night. And, you know, these are guys that tour and do big stuff, but they're coming in and working out material in these free spaces because they know it's a safe space. They know it's okay to fail. And
there's no pressure.
There's no pressure.
It's what you want when you're doing working in new stuff.
Exactly.
And in that stage time. For bits. You need that.
Mm-hmm. And so I think as long as you know the reasons why you're working for free, then it's okay.
Well, and I think that's sort of – I remember the person who sent the email to Scott. I think it was an aerialist from memory.
Yep, yep.
Which kind of makes sense because in that circus world, you know, you spend years on learning an act.
Yep.
And you have that act, and that's now polished as. Because from what I've seen, the rate of acquisition and development of new material in circus is much slower.
Sure.
Because it's so intensely skill-based.
Yeah.
Whereas we are blessed in magic and comedy and music that we have this ability to churn out new material at a much more rapid rate than, say, circus or possibly dance. I'm getting out of my edge of, you know, my knowledge of the different variety arts. And so there's greater value generally to comedians, magicians, and musicians as those places to workshop that new material because we have that higher churn rate.
Yeah. You know? I am. I mean,
so
it
sort of makes sense.
Very jealous of comedians. I wish I had the skill where I could just, you know, write some stand-up and try it out. But for me, anytime I write a new magic piece, I have to literally physically get it in my body before I can perform it. And then I'll still be incredibly shaky.
And you've got to, you know, build or buy or create the props and the equipment, work out how to transport it. I mean, it was Teller's great line that comparing original magic to original music, you know, a singer or a musician has to write the song. The magician has to write the song and then build and invent the instrument. For each song is on a different instrument.
And then there's a chance somebody's going to steal that
exactly.
and take credit for it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's totally it. I lost my train of thought. I was going to say, the Fringe Festival, going back to that, you're working again with John. Anything new you're going to be trying out in there?
Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, because it's weird how, so you mentioned, you know, glitches in reality, and this is sort of the great sort of fantasy of social media, you know, how it looks on the surface versus, you know, the other things going behind the scenes. It did do really well. It was a really good show. But it was also, it was a show that had some significant problems from... kind of mostly from our points of view, but that sort of problems the audience wouldn't have noticed, but that by fixing the problems, the audience will still get a much better experience. You know, that thing they wouldn't be able to imagine how it could have been better, but then we could see the flaws. Essentially, it was a show that was trying to do too many different things at once.
Okay.
It sort of had this overall thematic arc to it, which was really cool, but then a lot of the material didn't quite fit that thematic arc. And because that was the way the show was written. It was me going, I've got this great idea for this thematic arc where it's got to be an hour long and I've got all my best material. I'm going to put all my best material in the show so it's good and there's good stuff in there and try and find ways to make it kind of fit. And it sort of was in this kind of weird uncanny valley of like really good but still with a slightly subconsciously jarring disconnect between the material and the premise. And there were – and it took many performances of that to realize it. You know, because the show changed each time I did it in a different run. You know, I did it back in Melbourne and in Perth Fringe and other places.
Okay.
And so it was changing every time. I was tweaking it, putting routines in and out, you know, polishing the script and sometimes totally overhauling it. And so finally with Hollywood Fringe, we really realized this core kind of flaw in its structure. And so it's temporarily kind of in hibernation while I kind of look at that and try and work out a way to rework it. So what we're doing this year is just basically taking all the material and just going, you know what, let's drop the thematic arc and just do a show of, you know, Simon Coronel's best stuff.
Gotcha.
Do it, you know, just make it a great show. And it's already that's felt very liberating because before I felt kind of almost imprisoned by this thematic arc that was affecting what I could do and, you know.
I'm struggling with that right now too because I wanted – that's the thing with when John critiqued my show last year, he said you have a lot of really nice pieces but they're just vignettes that don't connect. And so I'm like, okay, how do I find that thematic art? How do I find the beginning and the end? How do I bookend it? I really want to bookend the beginning and the end. And then I just had this idea today. It's like I was thinking about Pee-wee Herman and his character. There is – it's kind of just chaos. There is no rhyme or reason. There's no thematic reason as to why he's on screen and it works. And I feel like if you can kind of find that happy medium, maybe sprinkle in a little things here and there of theme, it'll work out. So that's kind of the new idea I'm playing with right now. But
it's funny, isn't it? There's the phrase that keeps coming to mind is there are many paths up to the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
And many different mountains worth climbing. You know, it's there's so many ways to do a really good because, you know, it's like what is something I think about a lot is what is your metric for success of a show? And, you know, commercially, there'll be a metric. It's, you know, making enough money to be rich or comfortably living or whatever. But then creatively, you know, and kind of both tie in. And to me, the big metric is will people spontaneously rave to their friends about how they have to see this show?
Yeah.
That's really it. That's sort of – and that kind of comes into both commerce and art and marketing theory. That's sort of the single metric I keep coming back to.
Just word of mouth.
Yeah. Well, because there's this theory in a friend in marketing told me about this concept that they measure for in marketing questionnaires or sales, marketing, PR, whatever, about the question is on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you to recommend this thing, product, whatever, to people you know? And apparently, long story short, there's a lot of theory that comes to that is the key predictor of the success of a product. Or a service or an event or whatever, is how likely are people to recommend it to people? Because that's how sales and word of mouth spread. And also that reflects its quality. You know, that's implicitly, you know, measuring it. How great did you think this was then affects that rating. And that's something I think about. And, you know, you can get that through a very cleverly interwoven thematic arc, narrative-driven show. Again, look at Penn and Teller. You know, you can also get it from just a bunch of really great stuff thrown together into a show. I went to see... about Rudimental, went to see like a music gig and realized like they just play a bunch of songs.
Yeah.
You know, most bands play a bunch of songs and people love it and rave about it and buy the album and follow them. You don't necessarily need that arc. It's obviously better. It's one of the many things you can add to a show that will improve it. But it's in I don't think, at least at the moment, at this stage in my creative, career, that I don't think it's necessary, albeit very desirable.
I think if it's organic, it really works. Mm. But if you're forcing in a theme, if you're forcing the audience to feel something, then it just feels forced. Yeah. You can't get away from that. But yeah, going back to word of mouth, that's super strong. And, in this internet culture, really is the only way to get tickets sold or get information or get your name out there.
And it's funny how the best way to get word of mouth is to have the show be so damn amazing. That, it's like all these, get people to Instagram and tweet it. Well, yeah, that works, but just make the show so great.
Yeah, I don't know where I stand with I do feel like I Twitter, I Instagram, I Facebook, but I do feel like it's a colossal waste of time.
Yeah,
and I don't feel like what you put into it is what you get out of it, But yeah, I think it does make me happy that word of mouth is still the most important way for someone to come and want to see you. But it for me, it's like I want somebody to, like you said, organically bring it up to their friends. But it's almost worse for me if they say, hey, that was a great job, and then never say anything about it. You have to kind of go over that hill of, no, I need to tell everybody about this.
Yeah, exactly, which is a much higher hill. Yeah. It's not enough for people to love it. They've got to love it so much they tell everyone. And I keep thinking about shows throughout my life that I've done that for, and it's rare.
Sure.
I tend to be pretty low key. Like, I'm not a natural broadcast communicator.
Same.
I like to prefer one on one and small groups. And social media makes me feel very weird and icky. I'm just not completely comfortable with it at all. But shows I've seen where I immediately went, oh my God, go see this show. Just go buy tickets to this show right now. Thank me later. Just go do it. When I feel that about how great a show is, it's never because they tried some clever thing to get me to tweet about it. No, that's not. I'm just like, F you. You're an asshole.
Yeah.
But again, that's me. I'm very niche in that regard. A lot of people are totally, oh, yeah, cool, I'll tweet it. Yay, it's social media.
Yeah.
This is tricky.
I don't understand Snapchat. I got on just recently. Just because I was told a friend of a friend does these really weird Snapchats and you have to go on and see it. So, I'll occasionally take a peek and check, but I sound like such an old person, but it's like, if you're putting it out there and it's temporary and you can only see it for a day or however long it stays up there.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the point? Like, at least with Instagram and Twitter, it's a marketing device.
Yeah, you build a portfolio of stuff.
Yeah.
It's funny I love the irony that Snapchat was made in a response to this sort of social media obsession to take it back to more real seeming, the temporariness of real human interaction.
Yeah,
that was actually the theory behind it, which is hilarious that now it ends up being even more alienating to, more traditional, older humans, us now.
I do feel like it's television before DVRs. When something was on at 8 o'clock, you had to catch it then or else you wouldn't see it. And that's the only thing maybe I do respect about it.
Interesting.
But I feel like most of the stuff being put up there is just crap and a waste of time.
Well, that's the internet full stop, right? Social media in particular. It's like, I remember back when Web 2.0 was a new thing, which basically meant, everyone interacting with each other via the web rather than websites being viewed by people.
Sure.
I remember, but I got, I downloaded Snapchat a while back to check it out, and as a former software engineer, my background was in user interface design. Just the user interface offended me. It was like so counterintuitively designed, and that's not an age thing. That's just a bad user interface.
No, same thing. I'm very technologically savvy.
And you're like, what? And you're like, where is the? I still can't find the menus in the damn app.
Unless apparently you're 12, you can't figure it out.
Or it could just be that when you're 12, you don't care. It's like, tap that. You don't actually even know how to use it. You just just broadcast everything.
I just snap the weirdest photos ever. Just like once a month, I'll throw something out there just to see if anyone cares.
Yeah.
But the whole reason I got on was because I was doing a pretty fancy corporate gig, and apparently I was performing for some like rap lady. Mm. I don't know who she was, but she's like, I'm going to Snapchat this. I'm like, oh, cool. I'll get some press out of this. Awesome. Because she has a lot of followers. That's awesome. And then I go on there. And I'm like, oh, this is only up here for a couple hours. Yeah. And nobody's going to see it. Yeah. Just a colossal waste of time.
Yeah.
But what are your, getting back to you, what are your...
Yeah, let's talk about me.
It's enough about me and Snapchat and my complaints. What are your, any beyond Fringe, what are your kind of career ambitions, things that you would like to do down the line?
It's really, the big thing for me, I mean, as an ex-corporate myself, you know, recovering corporate, reformed corporate, it makes so much sense to be in the corporate entertainment market. I know that's where a lot of money is, that's where a lot of good gigs are, and that's the stuff, I speak their language, you know, I know how they work, because I've lived amongst them for years. And I mean, it's two things, it's really... both be achieve sort of creative satisfaction, you know, creative self-actualization in terms of just doing really good stuff for its own sake. That's what I care about. But PS also, you know, make a good living.
Yeah.
That would be nice. But the problem is all my natural energy is on the former, which doesn't at all correlate with the latter. You know, we know it's, you know, there's a lot of like hacky magicians doing hacky material, getting great gigs and earning a lot of money because they focus on the sales and marketing. And that's their brilliance. You know, they're brilliant at that, which, you know, I deeply and genuinely envy.
Yeah.
You know, because as we know, being a magician isn't just about doing the shows and the tricks. It's about the sales and the marketing.
Yeah. I mean, that was Orlando. I mean, the whole time there, you saw a lot of that. And it was frustrating.
Yeah. And it's funny. I mean, I found myself forced to kind of reframe it in my head going, you know what? Like, purely objectively, they are better magicians than me. Because they overall, you know, if you measure it by that side of success, you know, that the business side as well, yeah, you know what? They're better at that than me. Yeah. And that's a skill. It's a bit like, you know, if someone is a really great technician but a terrible performer, they're a terrible magician.
Hmm.
Like, you are not a good magician if only your technique is good, but you can't entertain an audience with it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a step beyond that. You know, going, you know what? If your technique and your performance is great, but you can't market and sell it, sadly, and I wish this weren't the case, but it's an unfair world, you still suck.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of realized, man, I actually suck. This is I need to get better. I need to improve this. So that's sort of the biggest thing that is on my agenda right now. I spent most of the last 5 years focusing on like just being the best performer I could be, doing the best material and, you know, innovating with material and doing good, original, personal, powerful, magical, entertaining, funny stuff. And now I'm like, all right, even though I want to keep working on that for the rest of my life and keep getting better forever, you know, and take it as far as I can, I'm now kind of forcing myself to go, all right, let's look at commercializing this. You know, it's something I don't want to do, but right now that's sort of the biggest challenge I'm facing in the near future.
Yeah.
And so we're sort of, again, coming for Fringe, for example, a lot of the new material I've been working on, you know, it's like if you imagine sort of the two axes, like on the x-axis, you know, how much you enjoy it, how satisfying is it creatively? And on the y-axis, how commercially viable is it? To what degree is this going to get people talking about you, booking you for corporate events and private events? You know, because there's some stuff that's theatrically great but would never really work at a corporate event or a house party.
Yeah.
So right now I'm focusing on the stuff that I find fascinating that also would work, you know, that would – if a corporate booker came in, they go, oh, wow – I could see that at our conference.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now kind of skewing my focus slightly, you know, without compromising what I care about artistically and creatively, to focus on, you know, commercial viability.
Yeah, it's tricky. Like, I'm in that same boat too, where you try to do something artistic and then you're like, oh, this isn't going to work at all for a corporate event, you know?
Which hamstrings you career-wise, you know, unless you're one of those gifted few that, you know, have a manager or an agent or a theater tour or know how to book that stuff, you know, like, because then it can be great in those right venues. But, you know, there are a few, you know, gifted, brilliant, fortunate few who are in that position of being able to do that kind of material or just do it well enough. You know, again, let's face it, we're still learning. You know, all of us are not as good now as we will be in a year or 5 years or 10 years. You know, some people are good enough already to pull that off. But, yeah, for the moment, it's kind of almost being not too, quote-unquote, artistic.
Sure.
It's not, but at the same time, I think about when I see a, again, quote unquote artistic movie. Normally, that means kind of sucky. That means a movie I didn't enjoy, that felt inaccessible and, you know, self righteous. And I'm like, it's funny, you know. It's, I wonder how, I think a lot about how, you know, the lay public, the normal humans who are our audiences and our target market perceive what we do, and to what degree. A lot of people see a sort of you know, artsy show and go, wow, that was so cool and different and artistic and I loved it. And I think other people kind of think you're a wanker. You know, it's tough to know. It's very difficult because people just see it so – people perceive magic so differently.
I think a lot of people get that with Copperfield show. People get it. It's like, oh, he's trying to do a movie on stage. That's cool. And other people are like, what the hell is this?
Completely.
I feel nothing.
Yeah.
And you have to battle that.
I haven't seen it in the last couple of years. So
it's good. You know, he's
post-Alien and everything.
It's I haven't seen it since they added the dinosaur thing. But I saw it a couple years back, and it was good. It felt like I was catching the show from the 90s. You know, he went through about 10 years of just doing the same material, and it was a bummer. But
faxing it in.
Yeah, yeah. And he admits that. Yeah. You know, he's admitted that in interviews.
I saw – were you at Magic Live?
I was trying to. I was working.
It's the best convention in the world in every way. It's just so great. And they had Copperfield being interviewed on stage by Stan Allen as one of them, which is a huge deal. And I was so impressed. Like, I'd never seen him. I had never experienced Copperfield being sincere before. That was just not something I, you know, because, you know, I'd never seen snow and my grandfather taught me his ace trick and cool. Fine, that's theater. Good
Which
for you,
my favorite
you
thing know. About the snow trick is that he mentions Christmas and he's full Jewish.
Yeah, I know. And that's fine. It's just my cup of tea. I respond to sincerity. Like, that's a big thing to me. I respond to realness and sincerity. I want to I want to cut through all the bullshit. And so, you know, fine, that's great. His artistic choice, no problem. But seeing him being interviewed and just candidly talking about that stuff and acknowledging phoning it in, I'm like, oh my God, I love this guy.
Yeah.
And I really, my respect for him just shot through the roof. You know, it was already high, but I found it the first time I really emotionally connected with Copperfield, and it was great.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Yeah. That's something, you know, he's been very self aware the past couple of years.
Yeah. It's great. I'm loving it. It's so cool.
You know. What's your writing process like? Because I caught your Parlor show, and it seems like you seem to focus very much on the script, if that makes sense, in a good way. You know, some people kind of overdo it, but everything felt very naturally intertwined with what you were doing.
Thanks, appreciate it. It's always nice to know when it resonates. You know, it's like you never know what's sticking with people. Mm-hmm. You know,
some people,
you know,
when
you try to put out there, you don't know what lands. You know,
yeah. Well, some people just kind of, you know, ram it down your throat. You know, it's the same thing. Like my grandfather taught me this, and it's like, no, he didn't.
Yeah,
you didn't know your grandfather.
I mean, it's funny. There's several layers to it, and a lot of this wasn't really planned. It was just the way I discovered that I worked on material over the years, you know, of trying different things, is I think of it like, and I don't necessarily think this is the best way, but it's the way I do it. You know, there's a lot of pros and cons to it. It's like sketching a line. You know, when you sketch a line, you draw lots of kind of lines until the main line emerges from the different sketched lines, if that makes sense. And I work on a bit, and I've usually got an idea for the piece, and it might be this comes from software design, going top down or bottom up. You know, top down, you begin with the concept. I want to do a trick where I, you know, so X, Y, Z, you know, and then you work out the method and work out the script. Or bottom up, you go, wow, this is an amazing principle. You know, this is an incredible gimmick that lets you do this incredible effect. How can I turn that into a complete performance piece? And that's going bottom up from method, you know, upwards to presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of do both, depending on what I'm working on. And often it's kind of both. I've got a lot of premises and presentations I think would be cool, and I'm, you know, researching and discovering methods and, you know, reading magic books and everything and learning tricks and ideas. And I'm kind of doing that whole, you know, match the left column up with the right column by drawing the lines crisscrossing, going, oh, wait, this presentation could work with that method.
Oh, wow.
Oh, this is a cool method. Oh, wait, these two presentations could work with that. Maybe that'll work together. And I go out and I try them, and I sort of... And I know, I sort of go out with a bullet point script, you know, the sort of the semantic bullet point level, going, right, I need to introduce it, explain this point, ask someone to do this, explain this, then reveal that, you know, the end. And I go out and kind of improv it and ad-lib it.
Hmm.
And then I repeatedly ad-lib it, and each time I see what works, and I go, oh, yeah, that was a really good phrasing I came up with that time, you know, and then that was too clumsy, I need to trim that down next time. And slowly over repeat performances... kind of the script emerges like that sketched line or that groove you wear in the grass or whatever.
Yeah.
And also I did – one of the best things I ever did was I lived in London in about 2004 or 5 for a year and spent the whole year studying improv acting. I met the artistic director of an improv group who's – and they specialized in long-form improv, like really serious craft improv, not just – funny, short, funny gag improv, which is still great. And he was really into magic. And long story short, I spent the year giving him free magic classes, and he enrolled me in all their improv workshops.
Nice.
So I spent this whole year gorging myself on improv theory, and it was one of the best things I ever did, because it teaches you to, even when ad-libbing, to be pithy and, you know, to try and be pithy and succinct, what to think about with your script and structure, you know, even when you're improvising it. And I watched them do these amazing 45-minute plays improvised with four actors.
Long form is magic. It's when it's done well, it's magic. It's
amazing, yeah.
And I studied it pretty detailedly at Second City. So, yeah, it's... It's when it's done well, you know, it's just life-changing.
Yeah, and that really affected how I wrote material. I basically improv the first few performances until I just sort of discover a script that works, and then that kind of becomes the script. So I literally never write a script down. I've tried to, because I actually think that would be better in some ways. I have not yet ever managed to do it. There's something about the way my brain writes words on, you know, paper or computer that's not the same way that it says words in conversational performance.
Sure.
And I never end up with a script that sounds like me, ironically, you know.
When you're writing like an article for Magic Magazine or something, are you just writing that, or are you saying that into a recorder?
I'm mostly trying to write on the computer while swearing loudly and throwing things at the wall. I find writing excruciatingly difficult.
Sure.
And I tend to write in bits. I'll sort of have the article, and I'll kind of know roughly what I want to write about and what the flow of it is. And I'll often go, oh, wait, this would be a good way to say that part. And I don't write it linearly. I often write, you know, paragraph six, then paragraph two. And actually, no, paragraph two becomes paragraph three because I write a new paragraph one. And actually, you know what, I take part of two out and put it with six now, and then write some more bits and slowly kind of vaguely weave this thing together, again, while swearing loudly and wanting to flip the table and being very frustrated, until eventually it ends up, you know, being 700 words of hopefully compelling prose. You know, I hate writing so much. That's
pretty much my same process.
I think it was Dorothy Parker. I hate writing, but I love having written.
Exactly.
So when you've got a piece and it's great, oh, it's the best feeling. Mm-hmm. But getting there is a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I rushed to do a kind of like a monologue packet for a late night show here, and just I got word of it to submit, and I'm like, there's no way in hell I'm going to get this, but I'm like, this is a good exercise to do. And just that whole weekend, it was like, oh, God, this is awful. This is awful. And then you go through, I'm like, hey, I'm pretty proud of this.
It actually got to a good place.
Look at that.
But you walk through hell to get there.
Yeah. And I don't know if I could do that full time. So I think I'm okay letting that go.
I went through, as an experiment, I wrote a blog. And I made myself a rule, again, as like a way, as literally as therapy for perfectionism. Because it's the worst enemy of, you know, creation and commerce and everything. I wrote one article a week.
I'm trying to do that right now. I've been going like a month, and I'm already starting to slack.
It's the rule, one article a week, no matter what. And I remember my internal dialogue was, if like my entire family was killed in a meteorite strike and both my legs were broken, I would still write an article that week.
Wow.
Like that's and who knows if that's actually true, but that's kind of the level of going of any disruption less than that is not an excuse to not write the article that week.
Sure.
Like, I found that was what it took, like, mindset-wise, to let me actually keep going. And I did it for 2.5 years and before I trailed off, and I went, and my life was just too chaotic at the time to be honest. I realized it was not wise to continue this because it killed me. Every week was just tearing out my hair. Every now and then it flowed really well. Like, every now and then I just, bam, write a piece and it was great.
Yeah.
You know, but that was 1 in 10, you know.
For me, I struggle with... does this need to be said? Does somebody need to be reading this? Because, like, especially like with TV and the internet, there's so much crap out there.
Yeah, you don't want to be adding to that.
You don't need that. But like, if I feel like I can actually contribute something, and give advice.
And that was the other thing was and I actually ended up writing a piece about this. I can try and dig it out. It was on the blog about if you're going for once a week, if you're going for frequency, you have to make that your primary objective. Quality and worthiness has to be secondary. Which is a very confronting thing to do. It's not fun to do that, but it's either way. And I found that my obsession with going, is this actually a worthwhile addition to the world by me putting this on the internet, that was holding me back from putting anything on the internet.
Sure.
And so I had to kind of force myself painfully to discard that and go, just put a chunk of words on a page and put them online, even if it's vacuous, you know, crap.
which is most blogging and most social media.
Well, that's what you can learn from these Vine stars and these YouTube stars, that they have such an ego that they don't care what they're doing is good or not. And you're like, okay, I guess I have to learn from
millions
that.
Of people lap that up because, oh, God, did we ever have standards as a civilization?
I don't know.
Did we have standards, Nick?
I don't think so. Everybody gets their 15 seconds.
Exactly. And everyone's into something. And that was what I realized. Like, you have to kind of, you know, like, damn it, Coronel, get off your high horse. Stop being such a wanker. And, like, accept that, like, there is value in entertainment. If people find it entertaining, then it's entertaining. And you're not the one that should judge that.
Sure.
You know, if people like it, good for them. Put it out there. You know, mm-hmm. I had this thing recently. I went, you know what? I'm gonna start working on an invisible deck routine. Because why should only hacky magicians get to do that trick? You know, it's an amazing principle. Going bottom up, right? Here's this method that is mind-blowingly brilliant. And, you know, audiences love that. And, you know, I still want to find some uniquely me way to do it that adds something to it because I'm me and I can't not do that. But going through that, going, you know what, focus on just being entertaining and being – if people enjoy the hour that you presented to them, then that's a win. You know, that's a worthwhile thing. You know, are their lives better after having seen your show than before? Good. That's a win. That's okay. Hmm. You don't have to – aiming higher than that is absolutely worthwhile. But not worth getting so hung up over that you never actually put anything out there.
Sure. You know? Yeah. I love when somebody does the invisible deck on like a TV performance and acts like it's something they invented.
I know. It kills me. That's the worst thing about magic, because at least with singing, you can cover a song. But at least everyone knows it's a cover. And they go, wow, that was a great cover. You're awesome.
Yeah.
Really like
we
that way
you
sense
of your sung. Personality.
Yeah. You know, I love a good cover band. It's great. Yeah. You know, I was in – where was – I was – it was a couple of years ago. I think I was in – it was China somewhere. This Filipino cover band was just rocking the house. But we know it's a cover. You know, it's the great lament of magic is that the general public or indeed the judges on America's Got Talent have no idea.
Yeah.
And assume – and this is the dumb thing. It's everyone assumes originality.
Yeah.
Which is the – I mean, that's the human condition, like assuming things that aren't true, you know. Is the source of, you know, so many problems in the world.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a double-edged sword for sure.
Yeah, it means we get the credit, but then so does
everyone else. Yeah, I do have a tough – and I'll try to – especially – like I try to make my show as unique as I can, but with close-up, it's, you know, I'm doing stuff that variations on stuff other people's created for sure. And I'll always try to call out, hey, you know, this is something I invented, but here's my take on it.
Yeah. Completely.
I feel like people kind of respect that, you know.
I mean, and people, you know what it is? It comes down to, you know, that thing I realized, like, it's like the question of, you know, what do you do, you know, magician, whatever, but then who are you deep inside? And I realized to me, I'm a scientist and an engineer and a teacher and a learner. And I'm a truth seeker. I want to actually understand what reality really is and then improve that. That's what I care about. And I realize it took me years of my life of soul searching to realize that. And so that's why I connect with sincerity. You know, why I enjoyed Copperfield being interviewed more than Copperfield in the show.
Sure.
I'm like, because I connected with the realness of it.
Yeah.
And I realize that's quite arbitrary. That is not necessarily a universal thing at all. Some people don't care about that stuff.
I.e. reality television.
Yeah. They just want to see magic. Just do magic. I want to feel like it's magic. And I just think those people are morons. But I shouldn't. Like, that's my flaw that I think that.
Yeah.
You know, they are completely lovely people, and they just want the escapism and don't care about the truth or the reality of it or whatever. And so – but I realize that not only do we want to be creatively successful and commercially successful, I want to be able to connect with people who value the same things I value. And that's why, like you – you know, I'm like, we hadn't met before this podcast. I'm like, I like you. You're like, we have this similar value curve of like acknowledging this is my variation on a thing. Like, I've innovated with this classic concept. I enjoy knowing that and I enjoy watching that. And the people who are like us in the audience will also appreciate that.
I think
which is not everyone.
Yeah. But I think that's why I like this town so much. It's, you know, I'm going broke because of it's a very expensive town. But I am the most fulfilled I've been in years. And, you know, because I'm around like-minded people who get it. It's not about the trick. It's about the artistic intention. It's about, you know, this overall peace, you know, as opposed to, hey, this disappeared, this reappeared.
Yeah.
And I think the more people like us that pop up, the more we're going to be able to shift the public train of thought of magic.
Yeah.
And that's exciting to me.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny, I was thinking about that and it's sort of knowing it will, it's one of those things that will always be a perpetual battle. That's not a battle you can win. It's a battle you
never going to go away.
You will spend, you know, your life fighting, and that's okay. So as long as you learn to relish the battle and relish the victories and accept the failures.
Mm-hmm.
But I was talking with Shirogawa.
He's great.
Many of your listeners, I'm sure, will know. And we've been hanging out a lot. We've worked together at the castle a couple of times. And about this thing about, is it about the trick or the presentation or the narrative or the whatever? And the realization it's about all of it. It's all those things are, people going, no, it's more important that you do this, or no, it's important this. It's, everything should be at its best. It should be the best trick with the best technique and the best comedy and the best presentation and the best theme. Like, why not aim?
Yeah.
We should be aiming for everything. It shouldn't be any best.
Yeah,
we shouldn't be focusing on one to the sacrifice of another, because there are shows where all of them can be 10 out of 10. And that's when, you're going to have people raving to their friends about, oh, wow, you have to see this.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we strive for.
Yeah, that's the whole point,
forever.
That's what I tell myself.
Perpetually strive. And hopefully have a comfortable life in the meantime, make a lot of money, delight a lot of audiences,
mm-hmm.
maintain true to our spirit and soul and ethical selves.
Yeah, that's all you can do.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
We're
coming to the end here, but I like to ask everybody if they have a best gig story and a worst gig story. We've had some pretty good worst gig stories.
Oh yeah, the worst gig story is always the best ones. Mm-hmm. And it's funny is that you learn that. I remember when I do a lot of teaching magic to adult beginners. I really enjoy that. It's an underexplored niche. Like, I like working with people on that. And the biggest thing I find, because it keeps you in touch with how normal people perceive magic as well. Very valuable for that all important empathy. And everyone worries about messing up a trick. And one of the many ways I've found over the years to kind of help them through that fear into performing is to remind them that all the best stories that pro magicians share and comedians and everyone are the nightmare gig stories.
Yeah.
Failure makes for good stories. So when you go out and when you screw up a trick, in that moment when everyone's looking at you, try and think, oh, this is going to make a good story. For me, probably... I was doing the Edinburgh Fringe Festival with a friend, Viom from Melbourne. We were doing a two-man show. We just wanted to experience Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And Edinburgh is a harsh mistress.
Yeah.
It's like you go there and it's sort of like the performing arts version of Vietnam.
Chaos. Trenches.
Yeah, just insane. And, broken dreams and mm-hmm. shattered lives
just,
and everything.
Just to preface, how many shows are going on during that? What is it?
2,000 different productions.
Is that a month or a couple
it's
weeks?
It's a month. So there's 2,000 different shows,
mm-hmm.
each of which is doing multiple sessions.
Gotcha.
So it's something like, I think, 30 or 40,000 individual ticketed performances.
So it's like, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just chaos. And so we're doing all these promo gigs. And when you worry about failure, and this is for beginners, they think screwing up a trick is the worst thing that could happen. It's like, oh, please. Yeah, that's adorable. That's, mm-hmm. That's the thing. There's mm-hmm. so many worse things that can happen than screwing up a trick. Your audience dislikes you. You injure yourself. You injure someone else. The venue burns down. Someone throws up on you. Like, there's so many ways you can do a worse gig than screwing up a trick. And this was mine. This was the worst thing I've done in a gig. We were doing this kind of promo gig at a small bar, and Viom organized them all. I'm just like, Viom, book us into every promo gig we can find. Cool. And so we were doing like one or two a day for 2 weeks.
Jeez.
And so we've got a gig tonight. Where is it? We haven't even looked at the venue yet because we're so busy. And it's a gay bar on the outskirts of Edinburgh. All right, that's cool. But it's like, we sort of think, well, wait a minute, okay, gay bar, we've never performed in a gay bar before. Is there anything we should think about delivery-wise? Oh, it should be all right. People are people. We all want entertainment. All right, so we go there. There's 7 people in the bar. It's just dead. A couple of couples, a guy at the bar who just instantly looks like he loathes us. And so we're performing on the stage to this just empty, dead room, and we're working hard, we're trying our thing, guaranteed killer laugh lines, getting nothing, And then finally, I do a line in one of my routines, and the barman laughs loudly, and I'm like, and this is the first actual connection I felt with the audience the whole show, and I'm going, see, the bar guy gets it, thank you, bar guy. Yeah, not a guy.
the bar girl with a very boyish androgynous haircut instantly looks horrified. I instantly, seeing her reaction, realize the mistake I've made. And what do you do at that point? What, you know, what's the recovery? There's nothing else. And I just go, I am so sorry. You know, we get through the rest of the show and just leave. It's, you know, what do you do at that point? You've alienated the one person you were connecting with. And we have the gig on video because I make a policy of trying to video every show. We've never watched it. Well, somewhere in the archives is me calling a chick a dude.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, I have a couple of those, and I'm glad they're not in video, so I'm not tempted to watch.
Yeah,
but that's crazy. Well, thank you so much for doing this free podcast.
No worries.
It was a great conversation.
Pleasure.
And we have your friend show.
Yeah.
And my friend show competing against each other at a battle of the wits.
Nah, we're gonna we share.
We're doing completely different shows. Don't worry.
Exactly. Well, it's also good. It's like if you like this, that you may also enjoy this other magic show.
Yeah. You know, no, I think it'll be good because we'll be able to I don't know if there's any other magic going on, but it's nice because they're going to be so vastly different in style. So
and
it'll
probably
be great.
Both good, which is nice. That's always that thing.
Hopefully.
That's one of the things I love about L.A. There is so much work to be had out here that there's less – it feels like less need to compete.
Yeah, I felt
so
that too.
There's so much available. And in a smaller city, everyone gets kind of more cagey about their gigs.
I felt that in Orlando. Yeah. It was – I felt so caged in. But here it's like, everybody's in entertainment.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Anyone can potentially get a TV show. You know, Carbonaro got a TV show. Fucking good for him.
Yeah.
That makes it more likely I'll be able to get one with a different network because his is successful.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Which is great about
this place. Yeah, that's good to know. Well, thank you so much. Good to
no
talk
worries.
With you.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Two Magicians, One Mic podcasts. Please rate us on iTunes. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Visit our website, www.twomagiciansonemic.com. Send fan mail or hate mail to twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com. Have a great week.